Support for I Am London comes from Endure. Kyle Creek, also known as The Captain, is a writer, father, leader, and self-proclaimed instigator. His books include F***ing History, Speech Therapy, and also two children's books, William is a Weirdo and Sarah Lives in Space, famously illustrated by his father. He's currently embracing fatherhood as his son recently turned 4 and is taking on the responsibility of being called to do more. Kyle Creek, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How's California treating you, brother?
It's California. I try to get away from this place, but every time it draws me back somehow. I mean, I was born here. I was born down in El Cajon, but I grew up most of my life in Utah. And so it was funny, when I grew up as a kid in Utah, I didn't want to be from Utah, so I told everyone I was born in California. I made sure they knew that I was born in California because as a kid, I just wanted to get out of Utah. It's why I got into reading so much, too. It was like novels for me when I was, 8, 9, 10 years old were a real escape. I still remember the first time I read The Count of Monte Cristo because...
Oh, it's a great movie.
Yeah, it's great. It's an even better book.
Of course.
I was in the backyard of my home in Mapleton, Utah, and I believe it was a Saturday because my older brother was cutting the lawn, and I was laying in a little hammock I'd made out of tying an old quilt to a playset, and I was reading The Count of Monte Cristo, and it just completely changed the way I viewed the world just reading these books. And at that age, I just wanted to travel. I wanted to be anywhere other than I was. And so, like I said, it was funny. I told everyone I'm from California. And then I got older and I loved being from Utah. I liked it because it was unique. Particularly when I moved to like New York City and, some of these larger cities, I liked the fact that I wasn't from there. I've always kind of felt most comfortable in places where I'm uncomfortable. And I think that still reflects a lot in my work. It reflects a lot in the way I view the world. And so, I mean, to answer your question, LA's LA. Like we were talking before this, I probably rebel against it harder than I should. And I know it's something I need to kind of work out myself, but it's worked out good for me. It's been nice. And I can't complain. Things are coming together. The pieces of the puzzle are falling into place in ways that a year and a half ago, I never would have imagined.
So speaking of your childhood and mentioning reading a book at 8 years old, is that your earliest memory of reading? And where did you develop that love for reading?
No, I read a lot before that. I'd attribute all of that to my mother. My mom's always been an avid reader. She was my editor for a lot of my first books. First version of F***ing History, my mom read that. The only reason she stopped editing for me for a while is because my work got a little too crude for her. But she's come back around. She actually was the one that gave the first pass on speech therapy.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, early on, my mom got me into reading. And so it's when I mentioned, reading that book when my brother mowed the lawn, it was because at the time my mother would give us an option with our allowance. She would say, you can read a book and make $3. You can mow the lawn and make $5. And that's how we got paid our allowance was chores or reading. And I always chose to read. And so there was a summer, I swear, I read probably 25 Goosebumps books. However many there were at the time, I read every single one of them one summer. And I made like $100 or something just reading books. And
so while your siblings are doing chores, you decided to read a book and still make the same amount of money.
Totally. That was always my thing. I loved reading from my mom. And she's the one that really turned me on to classics. I know for a fact she's the one that gave me The Count of Monte Cristo. She's the one who gave me... Huckleberry Finn. She's the one who got me into
Huckleberry Finn.
The Invisible Man, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. All those classics were all Frankenstein. They were all handed to me from my mom.
And was she an avid reader herself?
Always
has been.
She still, I asked her one time not too long ago, and she thinks she's probably read 1,100 books in her life, if she had to estimate. But she reads a book every week or two still. I'll recommend a book to her that took me a month to read, and she'll write me 2 days later and say she finished it. That's just what she does. And she would often allow me to get a little more money if I'd write a report on what I was reading. So I'd do like almost a book report on our family typewriter in the kitchen about the book I just read, and she'd give me like an extra 50 cents or something. And so early on, I always had this ingrained in me to read and write. And it wasn't something that I thought would be my career until college. In college is when, I was playing football. Well, I wasn't playing football. I had a scholarship for football. I wasn't playing because I chose opiates over ball. And the only class I got a decent grade in was my writing class. And my teacher told me that I should do something with it. And it just hit me that I actually really enjoyed writing. And if it wasn't for the college time that I spent failing out, except for my writing classes, I don't know that I would have seen it as a viable career.
Did you enjoy that process of getting on that typewriter after reading those books
100%.
As a child?
Yeah, it was fun. I loved it. I loved trying to put my my thoughts into words. I've always loved that. And even now, whether I share my writing or not, it's meditative almost to me. And I think it's allowed me to view the world a lot differently than other people, because I'm constantly walking around, like I'll see a fan and be like, how can I make that fan relevant to something I'm dealing with today? You know, how can I make, you know, the fact that I was late to a meeting last week because of a car wreck, how can I apply that to my life or someone else's life? And so I had this, you know, it's almost like that neuroplasticity they talk about. I've wired my brain to try and make everything applicable. And it's helped me a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways, it's also made life harder because I overthink things I shouldn't be overthinking.
Yeah, it sounds like you've had a unique childhood, because I don't think anyone's ever told me that I had the opportunity growing up as a child to do chores or potentially read a book or do something where it could help your mind.
It was brilliant. It's something I'm absolutely going to do with my own son. I don't think my mom at the time knew how brilliant it was. I think it was just her way of encouraging us to, you know, get involved in reading and the stuff she was into. And she always read us books growing up as a kid. I mean, we'd probably lay in bed and read 3 or 4, you know, bedtime stories. And everyone I've told that to has had the same reaction. They're like, damn, I've never heard of someone doing that. And I don't know if she had long-term foresight on it and was trying to really ingrain something, or was just something that she wanted to do because she thought we'd enjoy it. But it absolutely shaped my world.
Yeah, I love that, man. How else was your childhood unique? Because that's very different.
I grew up Mormon.
What does that even mean?
I was LDS. I grew up in a very religious household. And I think that's part of why I read so much to escape. I didn't really identify with it. It was very hard for me. And when I got older, probably around 14 or 15, to start formulating my own opinions on the world, there's a lot of confrontation with my parents.
What kind of commitments did your parents want from you at a young age to try to get into the religion with them? And
I mean, we went to church every Sunday, and then you always have this idea that, I mean, the hardest part for me was always having this idea that someone was watching you, almost to the point that I felt like my thoughts were being read by God or whoever you believe in, and it made me feel wrong a lot of the time. Like, I would have a thought that I at the time interpreted as a sin, and I would beat myself up over it and be like, man, I got to stop thinking like that. I can't think like that. And it was just that overarching idea that I was being watched that really, it created a lot of self-doubt in me. And
about what age?
It was 14 or 15, 14, probably, when I was old enough teens to kind of realize what it was.
Yeah.
And it was really hard, and my parents and I fought a lot, and I would get grounded a lot because I wouldn't show up to church, or I'd say, hey, I'm going to walk today. And
did they put in an effort to try to explain to you why they were bringing you along with this?
Because no.
We used to go to church as a family, like a non-denominational Christian church as a family when my mom was married to my ex-stepfather at the time. And he always wanted us to go as a family, and I always got the impression he wanted us to go so we looked good in town. Hey, I'm here as the business guy, and I got my whole family in the second row. But nobody ever tried to explain to me why we were there or why I should have a relationship with Christ or why I should pay attention. So I only went to get dressed up and go to breakfast afterwards. And now looking back, you know, I think there's very powerful insights to that stuff and looking towards religion. But ultimately, nobody tried to explain it to me besides, hey, this is what we do as a family and we're going to church.
It was never explained to me. It was just something that was expected of us. Yeah. And my parents both grew up LDS too. So I think that was just the life they knew. And I think they were doing the best they can. I have to remind myself often, you know, I'm 38 now and I'm a father. My dad was a father at 26.
That's young.
There's no way I could have been a dad at 26. I was lost in my own life. I was lost through most of my 30s. I'm probably still kind of lost now. And so I think my parents just thought they were doing the best with what they had and what they knew was religion. And I think it also, as much as it caused me pain, it also benefited me in a lot of positive ways, because at a young age, I was very comfortable with being seen as the black sheep. I was very comfortable with being disagreed with, and I was very comfortable with having my own thoughts. And that reflected a lot in my early writing. And I think that's largely why I was able to build an audience on social media when I did. I was comfortable with confrontation. And if people disagreed with what I was saying, it didn't bother me, because I'd kind of spent my whole teens and 20s that way already. And so as much as a time it was hard to go through, it really formulated me into an independent thinker. And I actually am grateful that I grew up that way, because if I hadn't had that experience at a young age, I don't know if I would have honestly had the gut to pursue what I wanted to in life and be okay with people disagreeing with it.
Well, it's great to have a positive perspective on it, but also as well, did it have a negative impact at the time as a young teenager? And
oh yeah, I think it still has a negative impact on me now. I think I still have stuff from my early years I haven't worked through, as far as particularly just this idea of having to have everything together or be seen as someone who has everything together. I think that was probably ingrained to me early on with just kind of this fear of being watched all the time. And I try very hard to push against that, but it still is something that's so core to my being that I struggle with that at times. Yeah. Of appearing as someone who doesn't have it all together. There's definitely parts of it that I'm still working through, but I think, you know, just having the awareness of knowing that it's there, and if it ever goes away, great. If it doesn't, I'll still figure out a way around it. But I do believe that came from my early childhood years for sure.
And what are some moments that you were the black sheep and felt like it?
Oh, all the time. I mean, both my brothers stayed in the church for a while and ended up going on LDS missions.
Are you the oldest?
No, I'm the middle child. Okay. But I always deeply craved this bond with my brothers that we didn't have, because during those teenage years when I was going out to parties, I had like my friends who'd be there with their brother. Like I had, you know, friends who were twins. And so like I always fantasized that idea of having like this inseparable bond with my brothers. And I always wanted them to stick up for me the way I stuck up for them. Because even to this day, if one of my brothers called me and said, hey, I need you to come do this for me, I would drop everything and do it. And I craved that a lot in my youth. And we didn't have a relationship in high school. I never really hung out with my brothers. We never, aside from our early childhood years when we did a lot, you know, we fished a lot, we hiked a lot, we spent a lot of times in the mountains around Utah. As soon as we became teenagers, our relationship just completely disappeared. And it wasn't until probably my late 20s that I came back around to having a relationship with my brothers, because they spent most of their years in the church and they knew that I saw the world completely differently than them. And it was really hard for us to find something that we could connect on. But they eventually, you know, found their own way, and they also, you know, have fallen away from the church, as they would say. But it was hard for me. And I, you know, it reflects in my taste now in movies. Legend of the Fall is my favorite movie by far.
Great film, man.
By far.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything that compares to that. But it wasn't until, I didn't realize why I liked it so much until my girlfriend pointed it out to me and saying, you know, the reason you love this movie is because these brothers are there for each other all the time, and that's what you've always craved. And it like just went off like a light bulb. I was like, she's right. That is the absolute reason why I'm obsessed with this movie. And like the movie Hell or High Water, same reason, you know, when that brother asked him to go rob banks with him. I would do that for my brothers if they asked me. And it's something that I really wish I would have had younger in life, but we're in a good place now. But again, being that black sheep early on, I was super comfortable with making my own way. I always just wanted to be an entrepreneur. I never wanted to work for anybody else. I never wanted to answer to anybody else. And I was going to find a way to do it. And it just so happened that writing was something that I was able to find my way in. And I've been very fortunate as a writer to have the success I have had. It's all I've ever done for work, essentially, with a couple odd jobs here and there, like working construction or stuff like that. I've been writing for a living for almost 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And I know a lot of writers that I think are better than me that I talk to and I read their work, and they're very talented. They're not making money writing. They're still trying to have their breakthrough moment. And it was that young, almost just like, I was blind to the idea of it not working out. Like in my heart and my gut, it had to work out because I just wanted it so badly. Like, again, I said, I was willing to take risks that people wouldn't, and I would move on the flip of a switch. Like I was willing to move. I was willing to, you know, transfer jobs. I was willing to just do whatever I had to make it happen for me.
How did that time affect the relationship with your mother of that teenage years and feeling like the black sheep?
That's probably the hardest time we had. It was hard for me to
elaborate on that.
It was hard for me too, because I had a very good relationship with her prior to that. And I have to give her the grace of, she thought she was doing the best, but we definitely had a falling out. And
what happened with that?
I mean, she wanted me out of the house at one point. She wanted to kick me out because I was coming home with tattoos or my ears pierced, or I'd come home drunk. And
how'd that make you feel, man, for your mother to change gears on you, so to speak?
It hurt. But my dad really came to bat for me during that time. I remember a very...
Like in front of you and the whole family?
Oh, yeah. I remember a very distinct conversation I had with my father where I came home drunk and I probably reeked of cigars because we'd raided my friend's dad's cigar stash. I was probably 17 and I came home drunk, and my dad, it was a Saturday night. My dad was up late preparing his speech for church the next day because my dad was a leader in the church at the time. And so he was getting ready for church, staying up late to prepare what, you know, most people would know as a sermon. In the Mormon religion, they call them talks. And he was up there preparing that. And I came in and he came up to me and he just held me by the shoulders, looked me in the eye, and he said, "Don't let your mother see you like this. Just go to your room." And it was almost, I felt almost like he was protecting me. And it felt like he was understand. He didn't get mad at me. He didn't say anything to me that was negative. He just told me to go to my room and not let her see me like that. And I remember thinking, damn, like he might kind of understand what I'm going through. And then not too long after that, I came home with my ears pierced and I was still living at home. I was a senior in high school. So I was still living at home. I came home with my ears pierced and my mom was furious and she wanted me out of the house. She wanted to kick me out. And my dad said, "This is my son. He will always be welcome in my home." And when my dad said that, it meant something to me.
That's
and
beautiful,
so
man.
My relationship with my dad probably got better during those years. While my relationship with her was kind of splitting apart, my relationship with my dad got tighter. And my dad was an entrepreneur. My dad's been an artist his whole life. That's what he does. He made a name for himself as a painter.
So you got some of your creativity from your pops.
Absolutely. Yeah, so man. We've always viewed the world the same way in the sense that we just wanted to make a name for ourselves through our creativity. And so in my early 20s, even though we didn't agree on a lot of like the larger life view stuff, I was always seeking my dad for advice on creativity and how to pursue this world of being a writer. And my dad was one that really pushed me at the time. I remember another time my dad told me, he said, "You don't want to work for somebody else." He's like, "No matter how hard it is, you don't want to work for somebody else. You want to find a way to make your own way." And that stuck with me.
That's powerful.
And my mom was, "Why are you giving him this advice?" My mom was very off put by it. She's like, "Why are you doing this? Like, why are you telling him that?" Because she knew how hard it was for them to make the life they had. And she'd been through the grinder, per se, of them losing their house. My parents declared bankruptcy at one point. We had to move in with my grandparents. And she's seen what the artist life was like. You know, you have years where you do really well and you have years where you can't get a job.
So there were times in your childhood 100%. Where it wasn't always a stable home.
100%. Yeah. I have financial anxiety because of that. I watched my parents make and lose a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's something that still sticks with me.
Living with your grandparents, was there any, were you upset about that? Did you understand what was going on?
I was embarrassed.
On? Yeah,
I can relate to that. I was embarrassed, man. I was early in high school. I think it was my sophomore year. Maybe it was my last year of junior high. But I remember when my parents declared bankruptcy and lost everything, my dad bought this little beater piece of shit blue Chevy S10. And we used to call it the toolbox because it was like an old, decommissioned per se an electrician's truck where it has a toolbox on the back to keep all the work gear, and it was the only truck he could afford, and he bought it off like some fleet vehicle website or whatever at the time. And I remember making my dad drop me off around the corner because I didn't want people to see me showing up to school in that.
Yeah,
I was embarrassed by my family's financial situation.
Did you ever get made fun of or bullied by it?
No. Yeah. Fortunately, I was always big.
Yeah,
I was always a big guy. I didn't get picked on because I was big, and so people knew like they didn't want to enrage me. But I was very embarrassed by my family's financial situation.
Was it you tap into your creative side during this time, help you during that difficult time?
No, that was the time I was trying so brutally hard to fit in. This was before I saw writing as an avenue of anything. It was just something I did, but it was never something that I thought was going to help me through life. At that time, that's when I tried to get into sports. That's when I was trying to fit in. And I saw the athletes get a lot of recognition at school. And because I was big, I was like, all right, I need to play football. And so I pursued sports solely to fit in. They were never my thing. It was never something that I was passionate about, other than the fact that it made me feel like I had friends and it made me feel like I was a part of something and it made me feel like I wasn't a loser. I ended up getting a college scholarship.
Playing what sport?
Playing football.
Okay.
I got a college scholarship as a defensive end. And it was, again, it was something I only did because I felt like I needed to be liked by people. And I remember what happened too. So my parents, this is probably one of the most formative things that ever happened to me in my life, is my parents went from not having money. I went from being very embarrassed by my family's financial situation. But as like I said, the entrepreneur life goes, it ebbs and it flows. And when it flowed very heavy. And my dad ended up starting a company that by my senior year in high school, we got a house. My dad was making very good money. We bought a boat. I remember my dad bought a Hummer. And at the time, having a Hummer was like, what the fuck? Like, people in Utah had never seen a Hummer.
Yeah.
And he let me
drive. And that's before the H2, everyone.
This is
the real Hummer.
This is when the H2 came out.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
I think they told him he was the second guy in the state of Utah to own an H2.
I remember when they first came out.
It was the second one they sold in Utah. And it was a big deal. And to go from like where we were 3-4 years prior to that, my dad let me drive it to school. And just the way I was treated when I drove that H2 to school, because you know how kids are,
It
made me feel really good. And so I had just this, that is probably where the core of my financial anxiety and finding my self-worth in my income began, for sure. And it shaped the way I viewed the world. And at that point, I was like, dude, I just want to make money. I want to be rich. I want to have cars. And now I'm like the exact opposite, because life kicked me in the teeth a couple of years ago and kind of forced me to humble myself and reconfigure my priorities. But it completely changed the way I viewed the world. And then I watched my dad lose all of that. And now my parents are living back in the same house with the grandparents that we had to move into. And so I watched my family be very well off. And now, you know, my father's a delivery driver, lost everything, all his retirement, bad investments, people taking advantage of him. When he had money, he was overly generous with it. And I remember my mom telling me one time that she felt guilty for how much money they had.
Wow.
And I think this was probably due to the religion and the neighborhood they grew up in. And my dad, I think, has six brothers and sisters. And whenever they needed help, he was there cutting checks, paying houses off. Like, my dad was so generous with his money that he ended up himself in the end. And that is where I have said to numerous people in my life, I don't want to be my dad. I don't want to go through the same thing he went through. And it was a time in my life where all I wanted to be was my dad. I really idolized my dad because he'd made a name for himself. I remember telling people in my 20s, if I can be half the man my dad is, I'll be successful. And now I remember telling people I can't make the same mistakes as him. And so I had to almost remove this idolization I had for my father, because, again, he was the one who encouraged me to be a writer. He encouraged me to pursue this life. And then I watched it bite him in the ass by making the wrong decisions with his money. And so it created this deeply rooted anxiety with finances that I carried for a lot of my life. And in the past couple of years, post 2020, 2021, when work started to dry up in the creative realm and a lot of people started seeing, you know, the financial strain, it really scared me. It messed me up for sure.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Seeing your father go through that, how did he handle it? Was there positive takeaways from that? Since you've been able to handle the ups and downs of life, did you learn anything from him in that aspect?
He's been very positive about it. He still is. But I know he struggled with it too, because we've had some dark talks.
Yeah.
But the way he's handled it has actually been very admirable. He still keeps a very positive face. He tries not to dwell on it too much. And he still just, it's kind of forced him to kind of go back to what he values in life. And it's been inspiring, honestly, to see him deal with that, because I don't know if I could have dealt with it the same way.
Yeah.
I think it would have hit me a lot harder than it hit him.
And leading up to getting into college and playing sports, relationship strong with your father, still not as good with your mom, right?
Yeah.
And how did you lead into going to college with that opportunity for getting a scholarship, right, for football?
Yeah.
Were you tapping to that creative side yet?
No. No, again, I was just doing it to fit in.
And were there any positive from playing sports, even though that wasn't your thing, taken away now as a man? Looking back,
positive from playing sports is it really helped me understand that you have to pursue what you're interested in life. Because in college, ball is your life. If you don't want to play, you shouldn't be playing.
That's all you guys do. Football class,
film, all that shit. I ended up dislocating my knee multiple times because I was tall. I would get submarine blocked a lot, and I dislocated my knee multiple times, and that's what started my stint with opiates.
What they prescribe you?
I actually didn't prescribe anything. They wouldn't give it to me because they probably knew that I was going to abuse it. So I ended up getting from other people that I knew could get it for me.
Okay.
I think they might have gave me hydrocodone or something pretty mellow, because I think they could sense that I was going to go haywire with it. But yeah, I ended up getting deep into like Oxycontin and all that stuff because I had connections and through the sports realm that would get it for me.
How long was that process of going deep into using opioids?
About a year. I was really, really heavy. I was using them every day.
And what kind of actions were you exhibiting? What was your mindset like? How were you treating people?
I was just lazy. I was still very friendly. I was still like always outgoing and nice people. I was just lazy. I didn't have any desire other than I just wanted to, you know, snort a couple pills and then go to a house party. Like, that was my only goal in life, was just having fun. And it's just, all I pursued was just fun. I didn't care about anything else other than just fun. And I think going through that, so I had a moment where I went to a party on a Friday night And I woke up in my room. I was living in a house with four other guys. There's five of us living in this house together. And I woke up in my room and I went up to the kitchen to grab something to eat. And one of my roommates was, he was still active LDS, so he would go to church on Sundays. He was in the kitchen wearing a shirt and tie, and it was the evening. And I woke up and I was like, what are you doing wearing a shirt and tie on a Saturday? He's like, Kyle, it's Sunday and it's almost like 8 p.m. And I'm just like, what the fuck, man? I went to this party Friday night. I don't have any idea what happened to my Saturday. Completely forgot it. I don't even know how I got home. I don't know anything. And I had enough foresight at the time to be like, this could be bad. And so I called my dad. I called my dad and said, Dad, I got a drug problem. You've probably noticed that I've kind of distanced myself from everybody and you don't talk to me as much. And I'm probably going to, you know, fail most of my classes this semester. I haven't been going to school, but I got a drug problem. And my dad's immediate response was, I can be there tomorrow. Wow. And he drove down with the Hummer and a trailer, and we loaded all my shit up, and I moved back home.
Looking back, man, how's that make you feel as a 38-year-old man to know that in this darkness, you're able to pick up the phone and call your father, man? And
I just showed how strong our relationship had gotten. Yeah. And it was honestly because I'd been through those moments where he'd stuck up for me. I knew he wasn't going to be mad. I knew he was going to be stern, but I knew he wasn't going to be like, no, you're not coming. He literally came and got me. And I changed my phone number, and I pretty much never talked to any of those people again. I just completely went home. I started over, and I knew I had to get my shit together. And I ended up getting 2 degrees in 3 years. I just hammered away through school, and I was like, I don't want to be in school. So
what was the degrees in?
I got two business degrees and a marketing certificate. And because again, I wanted to understand how business works. I could work for myself. But I also didn't like school, so I wanted out as quickly as possible. And so I did summer semester. I loaded up with 20, 24 credits a semester. And all I did is I worked at a warehouse in the morning and I went to school in the evenings. And I did that for like 3 years.
Is that probably the hardest you've ever devoted yourself to something?
No. I've devoted myself harder to that with books I've written lately. But
no, I mean before, up to that
point. Oh, before that for sure.
Right,
yeah.
So I'm sure that was an awesome lesson for you.
I didn't have time. Off. Like I was in school or I was at work and I got everything done. By the time I was like, I think I was 22, 23, I was done with school. But that was when I was getting business degrees because I knew I wanted to know how business worked. But that was when I was like, I need to find a way to write for a living.
How did your mother respond to that instance?
She was happy to have me back. I think she wanted to see me get my life together, obviously.
And here to think about your biggest hurdle to date at that point. And here you are coming out of that with your family behind you, beside you, and you're finding your way in life. I mean, that is incredible, man, to be able to be in that. I can't imagine being addicted for a year to opioids. You know, I watched my mom drink herself to death. I lost my mom to alcoholism on Mother's Day, got a phone call at 9:32 a.m. to find out that she was dead, man, you know, out of nowhere. And I'm 25 years old. One sister's 18, one sister's 10. No life insurance, no stepdad to come save the day, no father to come save the day. And I got to figure it out, man. But to understand, like, I can stick by my own side. I can stick it by my sister's side and show up for them. And you can come out of these things, man. And I think that's such a great moment for you to continue to show yourself what happens when you apply yourself. As dark as life gets, and it's going to continue to come and hit you. And it actually never stops for any of us. It's can you self-equip yourself to handle the things that life brings towards you? And I just think that's incredible for your dad to be able to, not everyone has that opportunity, man. So many kids growing up today, these young men don't have anyone they can call, let alone a strong man to be, hey, Dad, I fucked up and can you come help me? I'll be there in 24 hours.
I didn't ask him to help. I didn't ask him for help. I just told him I had a problem. He offered.
Yeah, even better.
I had no intention of moving home.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was going to be other than I needed to talk to someone. And my dad was the first person I called. I didn't have a plan to move home. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was like, dude, I need to talk to somebody.
What'd you do to get healthier? Just stop doing it? Did you do anything health-wise with working out or eating cleaner or anything?
I always worked out because even though I was never into sports, I was always into being in shape. And so I was a power lifter in high school. I held a state record for, I think, almost 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And so I was very strong too because I liked working out. And it was something that my dad and I had in common. My dad liked working out as well. So I didn't change much. The problem is I just probably replaced opiate addiction with alcohol, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in school, I was very much just drinking on the weekends. You know, I meet my friends on a Saturday or something, you know, a new group of friends. Or when I moved back home, I reconnected with some old high school buddies. So I didn't like clean my life up at all. I just got into alcohol. I mean, even later in life, I got into cocaine and everything. Like, most of my late teens and 20s and early 30s were just trading one drug for another, to be honest. Now I'm at a point where I haven't done anything. I'm probably 5 years. I haven't touched coke or any of that stuff. And I drink maybe 3 times a month.
Yeah. And
that's like having one, I'll have like one cocktail cause it tastes good. Yeah. But like, as far as getting drunk, maybe 3 times a year, it's just not really me right now. I'm just not in the place I can do it. You know, my son's pretty young and it requires a lot. It's very hard to be a parent when you're hungover. And I think I've finally matured past feeling like I need to be out and about all night long. It's just not my thing anymore.
Yeah, man, it's growth. You know, ultimately, I always thought like I would drink. Not that I was a big drinker and always had control of it. It was never like my mother, and learned a lot from watching her. But I remember like 5 years ago, I went on 3 dates in a row where the women didn't drink. And it wasn't on purpose. It just happened to work out that way. And I remember always telling myself, this is kind of awkward. Not that I have problem being myself when I'm drinking, but of course I was more comfortable having a couple drinks, but thinking I was having a couple drinks and this woman across from me doesn't drink. And then here I am 3 dates in a row talking to these women and they don't drink. And I always thought, well, man, I wouldn't mind having a bottle of wine with my wife while I'm cooking dinner or going out, or I appreciate a cold beer on the beach, but I'm not a big drinker. And then now I rarely drink at all, man. It doesn't serve me at all. And understand, you're going to continue to evolve as a man. And what are these things that you're doing that work for you and that don't work for you? Yeah. And what were the things that you started catching your stride after getting those 3 degrees and catching your stride, man, and wanting to learn about business? And what was that journey like?
I mean, the first job I got that was actually probably using my degree, I was writing emails for a nutrition company. So I was essentially like a marketing coordinator, whatever they call it. And I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed it a lot. I felt like I had a real impact on the output of the company. Even though I was just writing emails, I was probably, I don't know, 25, and the goal all along was to get into advertising, because I'd heard what you can make as a copywriter if you're writing commercials, and I loved the idea of writing commercials. I thought it'd be cool to see something on TV that I'd been a part of. And what I really liked about the idea of being a writer is I could be a part of things that were pretty large and grandiose, but no one would recognize me. You know, you could still have kind of a private life. And so even then I was like, man, it'd be cool to write movies. It'd be cool to write TV. You know, it'd be cool to like be a part of these massive productions. Cause I always liked movies growing up. I always liked reading. I liked creating these worlds and these big ideas.
When thinking back of things you'd like to create, what were some things you were inspired by?
Oh, just all the books I'd read, for sure. All the books I'd read, movies I'd liked growing up, you know.
What kind of films?
Well, Legend of the Fall, that kind of stuff. But I mean, as a kid, I loved shit like Predator, Aliens. Anything alien related, I always liked, because that's like the one thing that really scares me.
You born in 86?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. August 11th? You in August as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anything that, anything involving aliens, I was always really drawn to, because it just scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Like the idea that someone could come down and just snatch you, it was like you're powerless. Doesn't matter how tough you are. Like if that happens, you're.
Yeah, I grew up loving films too, man, because I was in this place at times to where like I was living in a trailer with 9 other family members while my mom was getting her life together working 3 jobs. So I would watch these films and I'd be transported for 2 hours, and it taught me to dream. It taught me that this is possible. You know, I could save the day. I could get the nice car. I could figure out life. And I'm very impacted by films, and I can relate to that, man.
I'm the same way now, where my ideal way to unwind is to watch a movie still.
Yeah.
I just, not a lot of good ones. So I ended up watching a lot of old ones, because that's, I think like the golden age was the late 90s, early 2000s.
I agree.
But I even tell people today, I did a book signing not too long ago, and someone asked me, you know, what my favorite self-help book was. And it kind of, you know, makes me cringe even hearing that word, because I don't consider myself that kind of a writer. I don't think I write self-help books. I think I just kind of analyze the world as it is in a way that might be helpful for others to see. But I truly believe that fiction, good fiction, written well, can do more for anybody than any self-help book ever. I think if characters are written correctly and the story has the right driver, I think you can read a fiction book. And I wish more people would read fiction. And it's really where I plan to take my career now, is I still don't consider myself an author. I always tell people this. I'm a writer because writers write about the world as it is. Authors create worlds. And that's kind of my way of paying homage to how difficult it is to write a novel properly. And so until I've done that, I still don't like being called an author. I think I'm very much a writer. And I don't know that I have many nonfiction books left in me. They don't appeal to me the way they used to. I think I'm at a point now where I almost have to start writing novels, or I'm just going to almost lose interest in what I do.
Yeah, continuing to evolve.
Because I have to do things. It's the reason why I don't write follow-ups to my books. I don't do like a second version of whatever the first one was. I don't do that often because I just have to challenge myself with new things. And so I think fiction is where I'm going to take my career for the reason you're saying. I think done correctly, it teaches people to dream. You can address scenarios that might be very relevant to someone's life in a way that doesn't feel as judgmental. Whereas like a self-help book, I think a lot of time can give people more self-doubt. And if not done correctly, can actually make people feel worse.
Yeah.
And I think fiction done right, when you can relate to a character or a story, it can do wonders for people.
Why is that so important to you, Kyle?
I just feel like I have this weird purpose in this world. I just do. I don't know what it is, and I don't know if it's me being egotistical or thinking I'm bigger than I am, but I've always wanted to create things that help people, whether it's helping them laugh or helping them feel understood or helping them just make sense of their life. That has been my goal always as a writer, with the exception of when I worked in advertising, because your job in advertising is like, let's be honest, it's to make money. That's all it is. And so that's kind of how the captain started. It was when I was in advertising, I wanted an outlet to write what I wanted to write. And at the time, Twitter was fairly new. And I started using Twitter, but I used a moniker because I didn't want to mess up what I had going for myself as a full-time writer in advertising. I wanted to have a little bit of, like a safety net per se. But my goal all along was I wanted to make people laugh. I wanted to make people feel better about what they were hearing in the news. And so I wrote a lot of very current event kind of stuff and just making jokes on it back then. But primarily, it's probably because just books helped me a lot as a kid. I remember feeling very understood reading The Count of Monte Cristo. And like, I don't know why, but I just related very heavily to that Dantes character and just, what would I do in that situation if someone betrayed me like that? Would I feel the need for revenge? Hell yeah, I would. And I would probably want to go about it very same way he did. But I liked the idea that I could relate to a character that was completely fictional. I've just always wanted to create things that have impact on people. And I've been fortunate enough that a lot of the stuff I've created has also impacted me, and helped me. Because most of what I write now is me processing my own thoughts or emotions. And I always tell people this, like 95% of what I write online is me talking to myself. It's either me remembering a situation I went through, or it's me currently going through something that this is the advice I would want to hear. And I mean, it's the whole premise of that book I did, Speech Therapy. The whole premise is if I was sitting at a table with a buddy having a beer and he asked me for advice on any of these little situations, that's how I would talk to him. And that's why they're short chapters. They're written very conversational, because that is the talk I would have with a friend. And I just don't know that I would have I know for a fact I wouldn't have my own self-awareness if I wasn't writing about my own life. It's how I think more clearly when I'm writing than anything else. When I have time to myself to sit and honestly overthink things, which at times can make things worse. But when I overthink things is when I make peace with things. And so I need writing almost as much as other people have told me they need my writing. I think I probably need it more than they do.
Yeah, man. Makes a lot of sense. And as you're hitting your stride as working in advertising and also kind of tapping into this alter ego of the captain, this online personality, what was it like finding success in something that you loved and were passionate about?
Oh, God. It was so, that journey so like, rewarding. Man? It was so rewarding.
And what age were you, give or take, this get started?
I was 27 when the captain started becoming like a thing online. I'd get recognized at bars. And it was awesome.
So worlds started colliding.
It was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I loved it at the time. I remember, I still think about this fondly. I remember a specific night at a bar with my buddies, a bar in Utah called Gracie's. I think it's still around. And me and my buddies were trying to talk to these girls, and they were asking us what we did for work. And my buddy's like, oh, I work in mortgages. My buddy's like, oh, I'm a, you know, I work in a warehouse, or I'm like a mechanic. And then I'm like, I'm a writer. And they were all just like, no, you're not. I'm like, no, I literally write for a living. Like, that commercial you just saw on TV, I wrote that. And like, no one believed me. And I was like, this is awesome. I love that I don't look like I fit the mold at all. And I have a career that allows me to be creative. None of my friends have this. None of my friends have the opportunity to do what I do for work. None of my friends can just sit and pontificate on stupid, silly ideas and make a script out of them and make money for it. And I was just so stoked. And then when the captain started getting a little notoriety online, like it was kind of a high at times, very much so. Like, especially when I'd be in a random city. I remember I was walking down the street in New Orleans one time and someone was crossing the street and I just heard someone go, hey, it's the captain.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck? This is crazy. The problem with that though is I started to deal with a lot of imposter syndrome. And everyone likes to talk about that. I kind of am on the fence whether or not I think it's real. I think it's just, you know, we all have a way of just doubting our own strengths. But for me, I really do believe it was more imposter syndrome because I was literally getting recognized for someone other than myself. Like, I was legitimately a character.
Yeah.
And as honest as that character was, and I still tell people this, even though I was a character, it was still me. I still never lied about what I was going through in life. I never expressed an opinion that wasn't my own opinion. It was still very much me. It was just under a different name. And so it definitely was imposter syndrome because even friends of mine started calling me Captain. Or people I knew didn't call me Kyle anymore. They'd call me Captain. I'd look at what someone had me saved in their phone as, and it was Captain. Yeah. And it got weird.
Yeah.
It got really weird. And so it was hard for me to turn that off. I feel like I always had to be on.
Was there a time you didn't handle that public success well? I'll give you an example. I was bartending at a club in Santa Monica before COVID hit.
What bar?
41 Ocean, tucked between, what is it, Red O and some steakhouse on the corner there. It's not there anymore. It's changed ownership.
I'm trying to think of what.
Bartending there one night, and you know, I'm a little on edge still bartending, but doing what I got to do. And I think it was a long day as well. And I catch this guy. You know, you can feel someone looking at you.
Yeah.
And I could just feel this guy looking at me and smiling. And I was kind of like, why is this guy looking at me and smiling that way? And I wasn't like upset. I felt like a guy was like looking at me to hit on me or anything like that. But he was giving me this kind of smile of like, I didn't know who he was and he was looking at me and it was making me uncomfortable. Because every time I'd look over, he was kind of giving me this look. And he finally came over and he's like, dude, are you London? I follow you on Instagram. I love your stuff, man. Thank you so much. And here I am like pissed off because I'm mad. I'm still bartending, right? I'm not doing exactly what I want to do. And I'm mad this guy's smiling at me. And here he is doing what I hoped someone would do. It's like giving me love because I'm trying to put some good stuff out there.
And even times when I did get annoyed by it, sometimes there'd be someone that would be too drunk, or I had, you know, some people like trying, you know, they'd pull on my jacket or pull on my shirt or something trying to get me to stop. And even then, I just, it's like you said, that's what you wanted. Like, that was like, it comes with the territory. And I always had to remind myself that I built that. And it was kind of reassurance that my hard work was paying off. And even when it made me uncomfortable, or there'd be times when I'm trying not to, you know, have that kind of night, and I think the only way I handled it bad was personally. It was never anything that someone else saw or experienced. It was me feeling like I suddenly had to turn it on.
Yeah.
So as far as handling it bad, it's like I'd be at a bar and I'd be, oh, I'm going to go home by 11 tonight. I'm going to have a mellow night. And then someone would be like, oh shit, it's the captain. Can we buy you a shot? And I'd be like, yeah, you can buy me a shot. And the next thing I know, I'm 1 a.m. and I'm hammered.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I had to play this character. And I was, at the time, I was very, I don't know that I was ever alcoholic, but I drank 5 nights a week, which probably was the definition of alcoholic, but then I could turn it off and not drink for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
I was very social, and when I was out, I very much felt like I kind of had to be this character. And so if someone recognized me, and they wanted to drink, and no matter what I had going on the next day, you better believe I was drinking with them.
And you mentioned earlier of replacing the pills, so to speak, 100%. For alcohol.
100%.
And then where and when did that catch up to you in that process?
2019, when I had like this real, I had left New York And I felt like when I moved from New York, I felt like I was turning my back on what I'd worked for my whole life. Because growing up in Utah, all I ever wanted to do was move out of Utah. I wanted to be bigger in that state. And I, you know, I was 29 or 30. I moved to New York. I was living in downtown Manhattan in a very nice building with a doorman, living the New York life. And I made it. In my mind, I'm like, this is what I always wanted. I've made it. I got out of Utah. I'm fairly successful. I'm living in New York. I have no one to answer to. Like, even though I work in advertising, you know, I'm a creative director now. I don't have anyone that checks my timesheets. I don't have to tell anybody where I am. I pretty much do what I want. And I just make sure I show up to meetings and do the work that people are asking for. And I left that behind and I moved to LA around like 33 or 34. So a couple of years later, and life just wasn't working out for me the way I had planned. It kicked me in the teeth really hard. And I had to stop drinking because I just could not process feeling like I'd turned my back on everything. I feel like I just fucked up. I was like, man, I'd worked so hard for that and I just left it. And I'd quit a job out of ego. I'd moved to LA because my girlfriend and I had been doing long distance for over a year and I wanted to be closer to her. And I just felt like I just made a series of bad decisions and I was beating myself up over it. And when I did drink, it got a lot worse. And I'd wake up super depressed and I couldn't pull out of it. And so that's when I realized, like, I cannot deal with this weight of life if I'm drinking. And so that was the first time I went, like, sober for a long stretch in probably, I mean, I stopped drinking, I think, for almost 4 months at that time. And before then, I probably had never gone more than 4 days without a drink since, like, my 20s.
Was that difficult to do?
No, because I was so mad at myself. I was so f-ing pissed off at what I'd done to my life that I was motivated to do anything.
Fair to say you can't make the change till you want to make the change?
Yeah, I was so f-ing mad at myself. And I was like, dude, if drinking's going to keep me hating myself like it does, like, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
It was actually very easy for me to stop drinking because I needed change so badly and I was so unhappy. I couldn't keep doing it. I wanted to change.
That makes me think back on my mom. As much as I tried to help her, man, reading things, talking to people, and then she's going through this divorce and I'm back and forth. She has custody with my little sister for a week and then she stays with her dad, my ex-stepfather. And I'm trying to protect her and the little girl because my mom's a drunk. We don't need to let him know that. She doesn't need to be drinking and driving, but I don't need my mom to lose her little girl. That's not going to help the situation. So I'm in this weird little middle thing to where I'm doing all this and trying to figure that out, man. But ultimately, I understood down the road and ultimately to forgive myself for not saving my mom was you can't help someone until that person that's going through those struggles hits rock bottom enough to where they want to be helped.
Absolutely. You know? And everyone's rock bottom is different.
Yeah.
You know, some people's rock bottom is pretty shallow. They'll hit rock bottom pretty early on. Some people, you got to go to the depths.
Yeah.
You got to be literally drowning, struggling for air before you'll acknowledge the fact
that push away everything
you
love.
Yeah, you need someone to pull you out.
Yeah.
It's an unfortunate commonality with a lot of people. I know a lot of people who have lost family members to addiction, and everyone has the same story. It gets to a point where you helping is actually the least helpful thing you can do. Like, sometimes you have to turn your back and let people hit rock bottom, or you enable them, as much as, you know, that word's probably overused. When you help them continue down that path, you're not doing anyone any favors, especially yourself. You're going to break yourself trying to help that person.
But it can be done at the same time.
It's hard to break out of a cycle when it's been your family's cycle for multiple generations.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring up prison because that's kind of the project I'm working on now and where I'm actually going to focus a lot of my life in the future is... I want to work in prisons.
How did that come to part?
Aside from being a writer, one of my first jobs I ever had is when I was 19. It was working at a prison, building prefab houses, teaching prisoners a trade so when they got out, they could get work. And I worked on the crew that came in and they would have the prefab house and we'd lift them off the foundations and put them on a flatbed. And these homes would be donated to like Habitat for Humanity families that needed like a house. So they're building these houses out of the prison in Utah.
That's a powerful thing to be doing at 19 years
old. And that was one of the first jobs I had. And the reason I got it is because I was big. Okay. I could carry lumber.
Yeah.
You know, they paid me well because I was, you know, basically as they call it, you know, the bitch. You know, I did all the heavy lifting work, moving all the sandbags and cribs and all that kind of stuff. That was one of the first jobs I had. And I was working alongside these guys that were going to be getting out in like the next year or so. I think that was part of the program is you had to be like, you know, have a date of release. And one of these guys I was working with had been there for 25 years. And he was there for, I think, second degree murder. Had it been second degree, first degree, he would have been there longer. And he told me the story about how he got there. And he had found out his wife was cheating on him, and he knew who it was with. And so he loaded a revolver, and he decided to walk to the guy's house. And he said the guy lived 9 miles away. And he figured by the time he got there, he would have talked himself out of it. But by the time he got there, he was so pissed, he just walked 9 miles. He shot the guy as soon as he saw him. And he told me, he said, "Kyle, if there's anything, he's like, I'll probably never see you again. But if there's one thing I can tell you, you have to control your anger." He's like, "If you let anger control your life, you're going to end up here just like me." And that stuck with me. Like, that stuck with me more than anything I'd ever heard in any church sermon or anything I'd ever read in the Bible. Like, that coming from that guy who had clearly fucked up, him sharing that with me, I've thought about that multiple times a week for my entire life.
That's powerful.
And when I get angry, I think about that conversation with him.
One of the things I try to tell myself is, what are the consequences if you get angry?
Yeah.
What can happen?
You're not thinking clearly when you're mad.
Yep.
And it's like what you said. You said, you know, you get these good people that make one bad decision. So I've been working on these projects and figuring out how I'm going to, you know, involve myself in the prison system. And one of the partners I'm working with on this writing project, I told him that story, and he says, "Dude, how many of us take that walk but turn around on mile 8? And I was like, "Dude, that was very profound. I love the way he put that. How many of us take that 9 mile walk and turn around on mile 8? Like, how many of us have been one decision away from being in that same position? And that is really why I do want to, I mean, you were talking earlier about how you want to work with youth. I want to work with prisoners. I want to help these guys tell their stories and take things that they have done wrong and turn them into positive.
That's beautiful, man.
Things. So I would like to volunteer to prison and teach writing courses, just like I have taken all my own mistakes. And like I said, most of what I write is me talking to myself. I would like to help these guys take their own pain, their own mistakes, and turn it into something, whether it's just something for themselves, helping them write through it, or it's something that comes out. That's my real focus. And I feel like I was put in that situation early on for a reason. And I've had things come back into my life the last few years. I mean, the major book I just worked on took me 2.5 years to write, but it is about an individual's experience in prison. It's a memoir that I helped him write. And I mean, I wrote it, but he told me his story. And I felt really honored that he trusted me to tell his story. And I think it's going to be probably one of the most powerful books to come out when it does come out in that year. And just all the research I had to do for that. And just, I've always had friends that are lowlifes. Like, honestly, a lot of my friends have been in prison. A lot of my friends do things that should probably put them in prison. And I've just always been kind of drawn to those people, and they've been drawn to me for a reason. And I just feel like I have to do something with it. And I, you know, it's like when you have a kid that's in a gang, say, for example, you got a 14-year-old that's getting into a gang life. Nothing his mom's going to tell him is going to keep him out. Nothing his pastor's going to tell him is going to keep him out. But if you get a former gang member to talk to him, you get a guy who did 15 years for armed robbery to talk to him, that's who's going to get through to him. And I feel like a lot of people who have made the gravest mistakes in life probably have more wisdom to offer and should be sitting here instead of me, honestly. You know, I watch a lot of these podcasters, and I see a lot of these podcasters, and you get these people acting like they know life, and they fucking don't. They haven't been through the grinder. They haven't been kicked in the fucking teeth. They haven't made grave mistakes. You know, they've had pretty good lives where, you know, their big thing is like, "I left a life of banking to discover myself." And that's like how they think. It's like, dude, you don't know the world, man.
Yeah, man.
You haven't been poor. You haven't made mistakes. You haven't fucked up enough.
Yeah.
And I keep telling myself this, that I need to find a way to bring those stories to the forefront, because I think they're more important.
I don't know if I'm worthy to be having these conversations or not, but I know there's people out there every day getting up trying to make the world worse.
Yep.
So I'll be damned if I'm not going to get up and try to do my part to make things better.
I respect
and
that.
Find men like you that are willing to put it on the line and talk about the good and the bad, man.
Yeah, I respect that.
You know, I cannot wait to read the prison book, man. And is this a ghostwriting project? Is first time doing that?
It was going to be ghostwriting, but I poured so much myself into it, it's going to be an author.
Probably project. Hard not to, right?
Oh, man. I obsessed over it for 2.5 years. It almost kind of ruined my life. I was having nightmares for a long time writing it because I was doing so much research about prison and some of what this guy experienced. You know, putting that into words correctly forced me to really live in it. And I was having horrible nightmares myself about experiencing that stuff. And
did you watch the films Felon and Shock Caller?
Of course.
Excellent, right?
Of course I've seen those movies.
Yeah, man. So,
the guy who did Shock Caller, the director, volunteered at a prison and worked as a corrections officer for several months to understand how the prison system worked from the inside out. And he didn't want people to know that he was director. He's like, they have to think I'm just like an actual guard.
And then you think too that, you know, nobody gets rehabilitated in there, man. And then you find out that prisons are privately owned and how much money's involved.
Prisons make you a better criminal, man.
It's heartbreaking, man. Do you feel hopeful that you could make an impact in the prison system?
100%. Absolutely. And I don't know so much that I want to make an impact in the system because there's just, like you're saying, it's just privatized. There's too much money and politics involved. But I can make an impact with those individuals that are in the system.
Where was that moment that you felt like you were called to do these kind of things?
Working on this book. Just realizing how healing it was for this own individual and his family, and just thinking back on what I'd experienced working at the prison at a young age, talking with those men that had f***ed their life up, and honestly realizing that the people that have made the biggest impact on my own life are people that have been willing to share with me their biggest mistakes. You know, those are the people that I learned from. And a lot of us don't learn until, a lot of us don't learn until we crash and burn, to be honest. Like, we need it ourselves. And so if there's a way to prevent people from having to burn too severely, you know, maybe you just touch the stove a little bit. You don't have to actually press your hand on it. I'd like to be a part of helping people do that. And I think just me as a storyteller, I'm drawn to the idea of taking something so negative and making it positive. It's the challenge.
Amen to that.
It's the challenge of taking something that people look at and think, there's no way I could do that myself. And then you tell the story of how you could do that. It's like you're saying, you know, you grow up in these families, you don't have a choice, you know. If you'd had the same life of some of these other people, you can very clearly see how you can get there. You know, if you'd had the same life where you'd been picked on your whole life and, you know, you watched everything just fall apart, and then suddenly you're 13 years old and some guy offers you jump you into a gang and give you protection. And for the first time in your life, you feel like you're somebody and you feel like you have someone watching your back because your parents were never there. You better believe you're going to do it.
Yeah.
And so I just love that idea of, we've all taken that 9-mile walk. How many of us turn around?
Yeah.
You know, before it gets there, I think there's a lot of sick. There's a lot of people that really belong behind bars. There's a lot of good people that have made bad mistakes. And I'm not saying they shouldn't pay for those. You should do some time. But I do think if you are going to get out, or if you have the opportunity to turn your life into something positive before the end, you should do that as well. And if I can help someone do that, I'd be more than pleased to be a part of that.
Yeah, now that you're a father, I can only imagine that the journey you've been on, and then looking into the prison system, what's it been like being a father? What was going through your life the day you got that news?
Scared the living hell out of me, honestly. I wasn't ready. It was unexpected.
Is your son almost 4 now?
He just turned 4 2 weeks ago.
Happy birthday, little man.
Yeah, he's the best age. He's so fun. You can have full conversations with him.
That's pretty awesome.
It's
man.
Pretty wild when they develop those skills to talk to you and like actually make sense of their world. It's inspiring too, though. I was not ready to be a dad when it happened. Things in my life were not, you know, as they say, things are never going to be perfect. They were far from perfect. Like, they weren't even close to perfect.
For example?
Just everything. Financially, my relationship, just where I was in a headspace. I was not in a good place to get that news. And for a couple months, I've spoke about it very openly. I was not a good partner. I was not a good boyfriend. I was very much stuck in my head, and I started drinking a lot again, but I had a conversation with a buddy of mine that just snapped me out of it, and I became very excited at that point. At this point, I love being a dad. There's nothing I'd rather do than hang out with my son, honestly. You know, it's kind of why I'm somewhat of a recluse, especially here in L.A. You know, I get invited out to things. I'm like, Dad, do I want to do that, or do I want to stay home and watch Paw Patrol? You know, it's like, most of the time I choose to stay home with my son, and my son goes everywhere with me. He's never spent a night at someone's house other than with his parents. You know, we don't feel the need to, you know, pass him along so we can go have a date night or we can go out and do stuff. Like, we don't do that. We always want him to be a part of things. I mean, his first year of life, he was, I think he went on like 31 flights or something his first year. Took him everywhere, you know, and he had a passport when he was a year and a half, took him to Scotland and took him all over the place because I want him to be a part of things. And everyone tells me, oh, I've had multiple people say, you know, he's not going to remember going anyways, too young. It's like, I'll remember it. I'm going to remember it. I'm going to remember what it's like watching him run around the streets of Scotland, bundled up as a little two-year-old. I'll remember it, you know, and I think that it's very important to get people worldly young. If you have the opportunity to raise your kids worldly young, I think you should. Because even when I started traveling a lot, it changed my perception of what I consider a struggle in my own life.
Gives you so much perspective. Majorly. And how fortunate we are to live in the United States of America.
And seeing other parents hustle the way they do in some other countries to make a life for their kids, you're like, ah, my situation's not that bad.
And also how many of the kids are doing what the family's doing to make sure the family and the business gets by and you have a roof over your head and you're working at 5 years old.
So I want my son to be very worldly. And I don't think I'll live in the United States for much longer, honestly. And it's not for some like political reason. I'm not trying to escape anything. I just think that there's chapters in our life. And I think that my chapter here is coming to a close. And I would like to probably spend, you know, the remainder of my life somewhere else.
And what was that thing your friend said in the conversation that helped you change your mindset of looking forward to being a father?
He's very well off, very successful friend of mine. He has five kids. And I had seen a joke. We were talking about a joke where there was this meme online that said something along the lines of, oh, I didn't have kids because I want to fly first class. And my buddy of mine goes, I have five kids and I just bought my second jet. And it just was like, I know I'll never touch that level of wealth, and I'm not trying to be like that. I mean, obviously, if it happened, it'd be awesome. But it's not like I'm like, oh, I gotta get a private jet. It's just a perspective. And I was like, I thought about it. I was like, dude, it's a perspective shift, like complete perspective shift. Like, it's all where you are in life. Like, if someone who's saying, oh, I can't have a kid because I want to fly first class, and my buddy's like, dude, I have five and I have two jets. Like, it just shows that life is what you make it.
Yeah.
And he told me, he said, honestly, if I lost every fucking thing and was living in a trailer, he's like, if my five kids were there with me, I'd be happy.
Yeah, and I understand it's easy for me to say because I don't have kids, man, but it just breaks my heart that not enough fathers take pride in being a father. It's like, I think it's awesome when you're into cars or you have like your bat cave that's all pimped out with your sports team, but like, you got a kid sitting there, your son that's watching you trying to be like you and the best version of you, and I just wish more fathers and men would take pride in that.
Yeah,
because it's your legacy, man. You're leaving it behind. They are who you are when they're not around, and it's like, what a great opportunity to like pour into a man and give something positive to the world. And it almost infuriates me that not enough fathers take pride in it, as difficult as it is. But once my mom passed, I understood that the decisions I make affect somebody else. So I've got a little taste of what it might be like to be responsible for somebody else. And I just wish more men would flip their perspective on it, man, and try to do it a little bit better. Take a little more pride in it.
I think the reason why is I think society, particularly with social media being so rampant, is we've falsely convinced ourselves that the ultimate form of freedom is no responsibilities.
Yeah.
I think everyone's trying to make their life easier by taking on less. And they think that when they get to a point where they have no responsibilities other than themselves, they'll be happy, when it's the exact opposite. And the problem is when you view all responsibility as something to avoid, you view all responsibility as a burden. And so a lot of people falsely view their kids as a burden. Or they view even having a dog as a burden. They're like, I don't want something to take care of because I want to be able to book that flight and fly out tomorrow. Like, it's just, we have this stupid view of the world, particularly on social media, where everyone's just like, you know, catch flights, not feelings.
Yeah.
All that just stupid bullshit.
But I've seen what it does to parents when they do put an effort into it, and the beauty in it, how it changes you. And to see, like, for example, Steven Navarro's father, Cuco, and to see him blossom and be such a proud father, you know, to see you on social media where you got that one picture where you're brushing your kid's hair.
Yeah.
And you've got that beautiful little caption, man, and it's talking about, and here you are embracing fatherhood, and a man like you.
While I'm healing from my own hair transplant.
But yeah, exactly. But you know what I'm saying? And just keeping it real and saying, man, the best thing you could do is be a father.
Yeah.
There's no greater thing a man can do. For me, like, I take such pride and having the opportunity to potentially have a positive impact on a young man's life, because I know what that can do for you.
My biggest fear of becoming a dad is it would make me less cool, in the sense that it would make me boring, because a lot of my life, like I said, a lot of my life, you know, I was partying and I had a lot of friends that were low lifes, and I'd find myself in some stranger's kitchen at 3 a.m. and I thought that's where my creativity came from. I thought the more chaotic my life was, the more creative I'd be. And so I sought chaos in a lot of ways. So my biggest fear of having a kid is that it was going to calm me down in a way that would make me not see the world in a way that was creative. But it's been the opposite, because when you watch your kid go through life and make connections for the first time, or, you know, you watch your kid just sit there and drop something over and over and over again, you're getting frustrated by it. But you got to put yourself in their shoes and realize they're realizing that, hey, when I let go of something, it falls. And so they're testing that theory out over and over to see if it's true. When you watch your kid develop that way, you can find creativity in everything.
Yeah. What are some ways you got prepared as a father to gear up and get ready for this that you could help other men?
I didn't get ready for it. I just dove right in. It was just baptism by fire, as
Because there's
say.
No rule book, right?
I didn't want to read a rule book because I don't want a traditional life.
Amen, brother.
And everyone that sent me a parenting book, God bless them, thinking they were trying to help me, I didn't read a single one.
Yeah.
I had a lot of people thinking like, oh, this book, I had a lot of people send me books, friends, family, connections, saying, hey, this book helped me a lot. I didn't pick a single one up. Every single one of those things went to Goodwill. I didn't even keep it in my house because I don't want a traditional life. And I don't want someone else telling me how to parent, just like I don't. Same reason that I fell away from organized religion. I don't want someone telling me that there's a rule book, because there's not. Life doesn't abide by rules. Life doesn't even know what the rules are. Rules are something we impose on ourselves. And I don't think there's a rule to parenthood. Obviously, there's things that are better. You know, sometimes I listen to some of my friends that are fathers that have good insight. But for the most part, I mean, I'm not trying to live the life that everyone else wants to live. Honestly, that's just not me. I'll never be happy doing that. And so I didn't, and my son's mother was the same way. We were like, we're not reading all these books. You know, they'd send her mother books or preparing to, you know, what to expect when expecting wherever. And she was the same way. She's like, I'm not reading these. Like, we're not trying to do this. We're going to figure it out and we're going to do it the way that we think is fit. I mean, you know, it's not to like pat myself on the own back too much, but I don't think there's someone that could raise my son better than me, honestly.
Couldn't agree
more,
man.
I don't think there's someone that's better out there for it. And so I didn't need to prepare in that way. I was like, I'm just going to figure it out as I go. Like, I have everything else in my life. And again, that probably all goes back to when I was young and I was very willing to be independent. I was very willing to make mistakes and learn the hard way. And, you know, I hope that I don't make mistakes that make it harder for my son. Chances are I'm going to. Everyone's going to. I just feel really confident in my belief that I'll figure shit out, because I've always figured things out. Even when life has kicked me in the fucking teeth so much that I had to just shut up and sit down, I figured it out.
What's allowed you to persevere every time you've gotten knocked down?
Purpose. Feeling like I have a purpose as a writer, feeling like I have a purpose as a father.
And what greater purpose than being a father, right?
Yeah, but I've always just, man, I just hate the idea of quitting. I'm not a quitter. I'm loyal to a fault. That's one of my biggest problems in life. It actually is a problem with me, where I'm loyal to people and things I shouldn't be loyal to. Because when I commit to something, I overcommit. I commit really hard and I obsess over things.
Set yourself up for heartbreak too, right?
Yeah, I do. But if you never had your heart broken, you never tried.
Good
That's
point.
Everything in life. Ideas will break your heart. A failed business will break your heart. Everyone hears heartbreak and they think it's just all about relationships and romantic love. It's not. I've had my heart broken by my career more than any romantic love in my life ever could. You know, when you have an idea that you believe strongly in and you try and bring it to the world and it flops or it gets cut down, that's more heartbreaking to me than almost anything else I've dealt with, because I believe a lot in what I do. And it's like, I think I wrote something about this one time. If you don't commit yourself to the point that you can be hurt, you haven't committed yourself to the point that you can win either.
Yeah,
like you have to commit yourself to the point that it's going to hurt when it doesn't work out, or else you're never going to see anything come of it.
And understand that it's going to continue to happen, and you got to be willing to persevere. And the more you can figure out what's important to you, the more you can tap into that to find the answer in the darkness, to find some light and take a step forward.
You're going to have your heart broken every year if you're living life correctly, honestly. Yeah. Something you're going to care about is going to go wrong.
And it's easy for, you know, most of us, we've had tough lives, and it's difficult to look back, but you got to understand you can overcome these things.
Yeah.
And you can find your way, and you can find purpose. But you cannot stay in that darkness. You can't stay in that dark place. You've got to find that purpose.
And believe me,
that takes effort and action.
I've sat in the darkness a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I've lived there, man.
I'm very good at wallowing in my darkness. I'm very good at that because I'm a ruminator. It's one of the things that makes me a good writer is I can ruminate on things long enough to turn them into something. But at the same time, I'll ruminate on problems to the point that it's not healthy.
What's the darkest rumination you've had?
I've definitely been suicidal. For sure.
Yeah.
Like, to the point that I was ready to punch my ticket, ready to go. I knew when and where it was going to happen. I've absolutely been there, you know? And it's when you just dwell on all that's wrong in your life for too long. And the thing is, it's very easy to tell people, like, think positively or do this and that. But I, you know, when you're dealing with financial stress or the kind of stress that doesn't go away, dude, I fucking get it. And that's one of the reasons why I feel drawn to dark shit like prison stories. You know, I feel drawn to the dark because honestly, I've lived in it a lot.
Same here, man.
I've lived in the dark a lot of my adulthood. And even as good as my life seemed on the outside, I've been in places in my life that people would not fathom you could go to and come out of it.
But ultimately, that's why you are who you are, is because you've been through hell.
Absolutely.
You found a way to come out, man.
And I'm not embarrassed to talk about it.
And how could you not want to share that with people, man?
Yeah.
That's why I'm so vocal is... I've thought about that too, man. I didn't plan out my suicide, but I've had those dark thoughts and then the shame in it. And like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
How could I fuck up my life so much that I don't want to be here anymore, man? I've got these friends. I'm young. I'm in shape. I'm healthy. I'm somewhat intelligent. You know, I've got these beautiful sisters and friends. I've got a whole future. And here I am looking in the mirror thinking about like, I'm tired of this shit, man. Yeah. I'm sick of it, man. And to be able to just take a deep breath and slowly find your way out of that, man, and to think so many people feel that way, brother.
I think one of the best things my son has done for me was like traveling with my son particularly, because I talked about that earlier. When I used to travel, it was primarily sleep until noon, so I was hungover from the night before, and then go out and party and see who I can meet. But when you travel with a kid, it's you're in bed by 8 because they go to bed, and then you got to get up when they get up. And when I have traveled now, I experience cities in completely different ways. And I feel like for the first time, I'm actually traveling. Because when I did it a lot with my friends in my younger years, or when I was working in advertising, I traveled as a creative director. But primarily, I was going out. I was drinking. I was networking, as they call it. Or at least that's what I told myself I was doing. But when I travel now, I actually feel like I'm experiencing things for the first time. Even going to cities that I've been to before. Like I took my son to New York. And that was where his mother and I met. And we met at a bar and got blackout drunk together. And then the rest is history. And, you know, we traveled to New York together. And it was very surreal for us because that was a city where we met. And that was a city where, you know, we were both in a different point in our life. And we went there with our son. And I honestly felt like for probably one of the first times I actually really enjoyed New York without any, you know, expectation of feeling like, oh, what am I going to do tonight? Where am I going to go? Where am I going to go to dinner? I was just content and happy to be there and push a stroller through the streets and just relive a bit of, you know, my memories of it in a completely different light. And my son forced me to do that every day. And even having my dogs, you know, I told people that one time, I have 2 Great Danes. I got 2 big dogs. And one of my Danes, one night, there's an avocado tree in the backyard, and he ate a bunch of avocados, and I didn't know. And so I put him to bed at night, put him in the room where they sleep, and I woke up, and he had shit all over the room. And it's a Great Dane, so it's not a little bit of shit. It's a lot of shit. Yeah. And he walked through it, and it just completely derailed my day. But now, any day you wake up and your dog hasn't had avocado shits, it's a good day. Automatically... life's easier now because I've dealt with how, you know, how shitty a morning can be to wake up to. And I think it's important for people to have something in your life that wrecks your plans. I really, really do. And for a long time in my life, I pushed against that. You know, I very much valued my independence. I valued my ability to travel. I took pride in the fact that I would go months at a time not returning to my apartment. You know, there was times in New York where I would pay my rent multiple times and haven't not been home. I would purposely just try and stay on the road or try and keep moving because I thought that independence is what made me who I was. And I didn't want anything to ground me. But when I finally got, you know, when I did finally decide to get a dog and just having the reasoning of having to get up and walk him, because I was living in an apartment at the time. I had to get up. I had to walk him in the morning so he can go to the bathroom. Gave my life purpose immediately. And I honestly, I kind of liked being my dog's employee, which is essentially what you are when they're a puppy. You basically work for them until you get them acclimated to your life. It helped me be more productive. And it helped me realize how much time I was wasting. And it helped me realize how much I was actually sabotaging myself by feeling that I had to have independence all the time. Because when you have such a hyper control of your life, something little goes wrong and it completely fucks you up. But when you're a parent or when you have responsibility outside of yourself, dude, you have so much perspective. Things happen all the time now. And I'll just look at them and shrug and be like, meh. It doesn't bother you. It doesn't knock you off your balance because you've dealt with so much in a little time. And
I love that responsibility outside of yourself.
You have to.
Like I said, you know, my mom passes away. Got to look out for my sister. I'm choosing to be responsible for this person. And then there's a beauty in that as well.
It makes life easier, honestly. It really, in the initial stages, it might feel like it's making your life harder. But 6 months down the road, you will find life is easier to navigate because you have your sea legs, essentially.
Yeah, man.
And I think it's very important. I always tell my buddies, I have buddies that are, I think they're fairly neurotic because, you know, they're in their 40s and they're still single and they live alone.
Yeah.
And the kind of stuff that like knocks them off their feet. It's like, dude, I always tell them, I say, you need to get a dog, dude. Just get a dog. Get a cat at least. Get something that shakes up your day.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that, every little thing feels like an inconvenience.
I can relate to that.
And I think it's so important to just find a way to just have something that honestly surprises you. You know, people talk about how much they want novelty in their life and they push back on everything that would create novelty. You know, novelty comes from the new and unexpected. And there's nothing more new and unexpected than a child. You know, you want to create some novelty in your life. Like, see what's going to happen when your three-year-old is left to run around the house for 15 minutes. That'll create some surprises for you. And I think it's good to have that.
Yeah.
I think it'll make you more creative. And I think it'll just make life, honestly, it will make your life feel easier. And, you know, people joke about this idea that, you know, the things that you care about when you're single or when you're living by yourself are so stupid. Like, honestly, the things that you worry about, you know, my buddy's a comedian and he always talks about this in his sets where he says, you know, he'll have his friends call him with problems and he'll just say to them, do you have kids? No, then you don't have a problem. You don't have a problem. He's like, I have 3 kids right now. You know, my kid's about to put his foot in a blender is like one of the jokes he tells. He's like, I have real problems in my life because I have kids. He's like, whatever you're going through, I'm sorry, but I don't want to hear it because you don't have any problems. You're single. You can do what you want. You don't have problems. If you don't like something, just don't do it. I think this idea that you need to be, you know, so solitary and independent that you can't commit to anything is why so many people are so unhappy. You know, you don't feel the need to be online all the time bitching in a comment section when you have real purpose in your life. You know, the people that are doing that constantly, they're unhappy. If you had something in your life that fulfilled you, you wouldn't sit online all day and bitch and moan. It's just the way it is. It's just the hard truth of it. And the problem is you have people with massive platforms that are those people. And so they're, you know, projecting all of this negativity or all these issues onto the world, and they have people that are looking up to them and actually start to internalize that stuff as it's, you know, it's a real problem, you know?
And speaking of having a large platform, where has it been negative for you in that process?
And I don't know if it's been negative for me as much as it took me a while to realize there was responsibility in it. And
elaborate on the responsibility.
So in the early stages, I prided myself on how many people I could get to unfollow me. I literally did. Like I wanted to write stuff that would make people unfollow me. It was like, okay, that was a good joke. It cut a little too deep. I did well. And I was pretty flippant with some of the stuff I would say because they were opinions or observations I had. And I remember someone wrote me one time and she said, you need to remember that you have a big platform and there's power in that and you have responsibility. And I think I'd said something that upset her. And at the time I was like, ah, f*** her. But as I got older, or when I started to get a little bit more notoriety, I realized there actually is a bit of responsibility in this. I have a bit of power in this. It's one of the reasons why I was willing to be outspoken in 2020 and 2021 when the world was an absolute shit show. I was willing to be outspoken because I'd created my whole persona on being outspoken, you know, in different ways. And to not do it then felt like turning my back on everything I'd worked for. It felt like the most inauthentic version of myself. I was like, I have to talk because that's what I am. That's what I do. I observe and I make commentary that people don't want to make. That's my whole career. And once I accepted the responsibility of having a platform that large, it really changed the way I approached it, where I was trying to, I got more positive with it. I tried to write stuff that was more uplifting than cutting. Obviously, I still, you know, express things that are, you know, gonna upset people at times because that's just kind of me. I think I have a pretty harsh view of the world at times, and I don't think that's ever gonna change. But I do feel responsible in the sense that I should be trying to put more good out there than bad, for sure. I don't want to be one of those people that's just constantly complaining. I don't want to be one of those people that's just rage baiting, which a lot of people are these days, especially once they started monetizing reach on these things.
Yeah,
or monetizing,
that makes a lot of sense.
Everyone rage baits, and it frustrates the hell out of me because it's not positive for the collective at all. And I've talked about this with a lot of friends of mine who also have large platforms. I do believe as a whole, social media has been a net negative for society. I strongly believe we'd be better off without it. It's changed my career. It's changed my life. It's benefited me greatly in personal and financial ways. And I've done very good, you know, for myself on it at times. But at the times, it's caused me a lot of frustration. It honestly has been what has sank me into some depression. And, you know, these feelings of, you know, failing as a creative or a father, I'm not immune to the influence as much as everyone else. If I spend too much time on it, I have very unproductive, worthless days. I really do believe that if it went away, there'd be a pain for a while, but I think society would benefit. And it's just changed my whole goal. I used to tell people, I say, I don't have a 401k. My 401k is my following.
Yeah.
You know, I can always lean back on it. And now my whole goal is to get the fuck off social media. My whole goal is, how can I create a life for myself as a creator where I don't need social media? Because honestly, I still need it to get some of my work out there. Like, when I release a new book, the only way people find out about it is social media. So I'm kind of beholden to this God that I don't want to be beholden to.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to find a way to structure my life to where I can create what I want to create, be a part of the things I want to be a part of, and not need social media at all. And it's like everything, I'll figure it out. It's a growing pain. It's hard right now. It's not, you know, I'm nowhere near that point, but I think I've begun to put some pieces in place that'll allow me to do that in the somewhat near future.
And what are the principles you're utilizing that allow you to be that man and help you move forward and create something that matters, that lasts?
Just pursuing what I honestly care about. Because I care about these things that I'm working on enough that I'll put whatever I have to into them to make them successful. You know, I really do believe in what I'm creating right now. And, you know, 90% of what I create has not been seen by people. You know, most of what I've done the last couple of years of my life, I have not received any accolades for. I've had no pat on the back for it. No one's really even read it besides from a select few people. And I think one of the hardest things for people to do, especially when you build a career on social media, is learn to work without praise, because you get caught in this loop of you always need affirmation of your worth as a creator. And I've learned to delay gratification enough in my work that I can have a long-term success come from it. And I think it's the ability to delay your gratification as a creator, and even as a human, if you can delay your gratification, that is the only way you can guarantee yourself longevity in anything. If everything has to come fast and be fast, it's going to fall fast. And it's taken me a long time to be willing to put in so many hours off social media to get to where I feel like when the things do see the light of day, they will carry well beyond, you know, my life, honestly.
It's been awesome to see social media and the impact, but most importantly, man, to see this up close in person, man, I appreciate it. Big thanks to our sponsor, Endure, family-owned and operated company that's been in the supplement business for 45 years. Endure is my go-to for supplements because they are third-party tested, no fillers, just clean, high-quality ingredients. The real advantage with Endure is their sustained-release formulas that are designed to release nutrients slowly, over several hours. That mimics how your body naturally digests food. You absorb more for longer and more efficiently. For clean, effective fuel for performance and recovery, check out Endure. Use code IAMLONDON20 for an exclusive 20% off at Endure.com. That's ENDURE.com.